Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, what brought the U.S. and Iran to the brink, and what comes next? It began when President Trump ordered the assassination of Iranian Major General Qasem Soleimani, and ended when Iran retaliated with a non-fatal missile strike against a military base in Iraq. But the deteriorating relationship between the two countries' leaders started long before the assassination, and as my guest says, will not end with this moment of de-escalation. Paul Pillar is a former CIA National Intelligence Officer. He's a non-resident senior fellow at the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown University and a fellow at the Quincy Institute. I spoke with him Friday morning. Paul Pillar, take us back. How did we get to the place we're in?
The U.S. differences with the Islamic Republic of Iran, of course, go back to the outset of that regime 4 decades ago. But I think for present purposes, looking at this awful spiral of escalation, we go back 2 years. You know, 2 years ago, the Iranian regime was abiding completely by the Iran nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The Iranians were not sabotaging ships in the Strait of Hormuz or attacking Saudi oil facilities or firing missiles at Iraqi bases. Our embassy in Iraq was not being stormed. It was about as quiet as things get in the Persian Gulf. And then in the spring of 2018, the Trump administration decided to renege on the Iranian nuclear deal.
Why?
Mainly because it was the major foreign policy achievement of Barack Obama. And as with other measures, this current president seems to want to do the opposite of or to undo anything his predecessor did. You know, the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal, has served a role in foreign policy that the Affordable Care Act has served in domestic policy. That's the main reason.
What about the influence of Sheldon Adelson in that regard?
Mr. Adelson has been a major influence on Trump, and all that Mr. Adelson cares about, seemingly, is to keep the United States in line with the Israeli government. And there's no question that the Israeli government of Benjamin Netanyahu has always strongly supported anything that castigates Iran, that isolates Iran, and that continues a state of tension between the U.S. and the Iranians. In short, to keep Iran as a pariah, that serves a number of political purposes for the Israeli government, including trying to enhance their own relations with the Gulf Arabs and making sure that for the United States, there isn't any other supposed friend in the region other than Israel. So yes, that was a major influence as well.
So we come to the present day when the United States, under the direction of President Trump, decided to assassinate one of Iran's top generals. Why?
Well, that's still a good question in terms of why and why now. I think lots of things play into this, including the impeachment and political situation here in the United States. People talk about wag the dog scenarios, and I think that might be part of it. But it's probably more just the overall influence of the hawkish elements within the administration. I would single out Secretary of State Pompeo in particular in that regard. We can't blame John Bolton anymore because he's not around. But really, Diane, this was probably the biggest single step in all the escalation since the Trump administration declared unrestricted economic warfare in Iran. This is the kind of thing that the United States had done in the past, but since the 1970s, when the issue became kind of a scandal, when things came to light about, you know, exploding cigars, trying to kill Fidel Castro, that sort of thing. And in the 70s, President Ford is the one who signed an executive order prohibiting assassination. This was not some common terrorist. This was, as you point out, an extremely major figure in the Iranian regime, by some estimates, maybe second only to the supreme leader in shaping Iranian policy in the Persian Gulf region. a senior military leader. And to assassinate someone like that is simply not something that a great nation like the United States ought to do or should do, and nor has it done over the last four decades.
What's so interesting is the way the president has now characterized the response from Iran to that assassination as they stood down.
Well, let me characterize the response from Iran. I think it was a very carefully calibrated response. They had to do something fairly promptly to meet the internal demand for revenge, something visible, something as obvious as a missile strike. But they also did it in a way that did not cause U.S. casualties. I mean, if they wanted to kill Americans, or Iraqis for that matter, at those two bases, they wouldn't have done it in the middle of the night when people were bunked down in their barracks. They would have done it during the middle of the day when people were around outside working and so on. They probably would have caused casualties that way. So they wanted to reestablish deterrence, to use that term, to satisfy the desire for revenge by Iranians. But to give Trump a way out, an exit ramp.
Why?
Because the Iranians don't want to escalate into all-out war. Certainly, an all-out war is not something they would win. Unfortunately, President Trump, although he did accept the no-casualty outcome of that missile strike as a basis for not ordering still more U.S. strikes on Iran, said nothing in his statement the other day that suggests he's really willing to de-escalate. So what we have is a pause in this escalation. We don't really have a step down on the ladder of escalation, since the president was still talking about sustaining maximum pressure. He was even talking about, you know, putting on more sanctions. That raises the question whether there's anything left to sanction in Iran that the United States has not already sanctioned. But he's still talking about escalation, not de-escalation. And I'm sure there are voices inside the Iranian regime today that are saying it was a mistake to have as non-lethal a response as the Iranians did, because look what Trump's doing. He's just pocketing it and then talking about more economic warfare.
Secretary Pompeo and others suggested that there were good reasons, that there were plans underway on the part of the Iranians to do devastation. And that's why the attack was taken now. And yet no one's come forward with any legitimately understandable information about what those attacks might have been.
Well, we haven't seen such information. And there's a couple other points, Diane, we ought to make about, you know, that rationale. One is, you know, Soleimani was a very senior figure. He wasn't a trigger man. He wasn't the person who was going to plant a bomb. So if, in fact, there were, you know, plans afoot behind an imminent attack, there would still be operators out there all set to carry out the attack. And instead, we've just given the Iranians more motivation to do so. And the second point is, if it's really plans, well, of course the Iranians were planning attacks. That's what militaries do. And they would be irresponsible from their own point of view not to do it, given all the, you know, threats that they're hearing from the United States. I can assure you that today, as we speak, in the Pentagon and at Central Command, there are plenty of plans being updated to attack Iran. But that obviously is not a reason for anyone to try to assassinate a senior U.S. general. Planning is what military organizations do. It does not equate to an imminent attack, and we certainly didn't avoid or prevent an attack by assassinating a senior figure.
Back to the response that Iran had on those bases. We knew about those attacks, those planned attacks, 2 hours beforehand.
Reportedly so, and if so, that would be another facet to the intention of the Iranians not to kill people, but to send the message, to give a demonstration of what they could do, but not force President Trump into a situation in which he would feel obligated to strike back yet again with a higher level of escalation as far as military attacks on Iran.
Paul, what can they do at this point? What might they do to continue, perhaps in one way or another, to keep edging forward with their own strength? They're not going to lie back and take it.
The Iranians, you mean?
Right.
No, they won't. And what we ought to remember is, even though we should be grateful for the pause that we're in now, and that the Iranians did not force President Trump into a situation where he would be launching airstrikes the next day, the economic warfare continues. And the Iranians have made it quite clear they are not going to sit still for that. Ever since last spring, in other words, coming up on close to a year now, the U.S. administration's policy has been to try to bring Iranian exports to zero as the main means to try to cripple the Iranian economy. The Iranians have said quite explicitly, if we can't export our oil, it's going to be hard for other exporters to sell their oil too. That was in large part what the attacks on the Saudi oil facilities last September was all about, a demonstration of exactly that point. Well, as long as the economic warfare continues, and as long as the U.S. policy is to try to cripple the Iranian economy and keep Iranian exports of oil to zero, we can expect more of the same in response from Iran.
Americans and Canadians are now saying that the plane that crashed came down because of an Iranian missile hit. What are you hearing?
It's almost certain that was the case. I think it's highly unlikely that Prime Minister Trudeau of Canada would have made the announcement he did if Canadian authorities had not been quite confident that that was the case. And we shouldn't be surprised that there would have been sufficient intelligence to determine this, given that this took place at a time and a place, namely central Iran, in the midst of this crisis, in which you can be certain that all the U.S. and other intelligence collection capabilities, including ones that can detect small missile firings, would have been aimed at that spot. It's no surprise also that the Iranian authorities are denying this, since it would be a huge embarrassment. But I think what we're seeing is a tragic byproduct of a confrontation.
An accident.
An accident, but an accident that happens because, in this case, probably you had, you know, air defense people keyed up on a hair trigger basis. What this reminds me of, Diane, was Iran Air Flight 655, which was shot down by a U.S. warship in 1988 in the last year of the Iran-Iraq War. That was an accident too, but that was also one that would not have occurred if we hadn't had an armed confrontation and very high tension between the United States and Iran.
And you wouldn't expect that the Iranians would admit to such an accident.
No, they wouldn't, although at some point, if forensic evidence is allowed to get in the hands of Canadian or Ukrainian authorities, they can't keep denying it forever.
Do you think that evidence will eventually get to the Canadians and Ukrainians?
That's hard to determine. The Canadians and Ukrainians have been told they can have access, you know, to the site, but in terms of whether they will have direct access to the flight data recorder and that sort of thing is at this hour still undetermined.
Now, a quick break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Paul Piller. He is a former CIA National Intelligence Officer. He's currently a non-resident senior fellow at the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown University and a fellow at the Quincy Institute. Paul, before this assassination, the people of Iran were rising up against their leaders because of the economy, because they didn't have enough food. What is the escalated economic pressure going to mean?
the ordinary Iranian does have a lot of reasons to be unhappy about the state of economic affairs in Iran, which is in large part due to the sanctions for the U.S., but also due to mismanagement and other economic mistakes by the Iranians themselves. And yes, we saw that in the demonstrations in November, which were in response to a reduction of the fuel subsidy, which is still it's still heavily subsidized in Iran. That's the sort of thing we've seen in other countries when fuel or food subsidies have been reduced or eliminated. But one thing that the strike on Soleimani in particular has done has been to unite Iranians more than anything else in the last few months has. The hardliners have had the upper hand ever since maximum pressure started. Rouhani, the president, and Zarif, the foreign minister, who negotiated the Iranian nuclear deal, have been discredited in the eyes of many Iranians who say, "We told you so. You shouldn't have negotiated with those Americans. Look what happened." Well, now, not only do the hardliners have the upper hand, but we've seen Iranians of many political stripes. We saw that in the huge crowds mourning Qasem Soleimani, uniting in a way that they weren't before. And that's a very unfortunate side effect of the assassination operation as well.
Speaking of those united, I thought it was fascinating the optics of President Trump's statement with all those generals standing behind him with all of their ribbons and brass medals showing very clearly on television. Are all of them in agreement with the president's tactics?
I doubt it, Diane, but we've had from the very beginning of this administration a very strong emphasis by the White House on these shows of unity. You may recall that initial cabinet meeting early in the administration in which Trump went around the table and everyone was supposed to voice his or her fealty to the president. This is the sort of thing we're used to seeing in a place like North Korea. Yes, this was one more show for the cameras of apparent unity, but I would be very surprised if the thoughts in the minds of those bemedaled generals was the same. In fact, we've gotten reporting, and the New York Times had this story a few days ago, that when the Pentagon presented to President Trump options for, you know, how to respond to these latest altercations in Iraq, that the option of assassinating Soleimani was in there as the one of the extreme options. This
yes.
was part of the old Washington bureaucratic game of present the boss with three options, and two of them are extreme on different ends, and you hope and expect he's going to choose the middle one. Well, to the consternation of those who prepared the options, Trump reportedly chose the extreme one, which was the assassination operation.
So in the long run, what can we expect as a result of this assassination?
Well, I think we can expect more, as we talked a moment ago, that the Iranians are not going to sit still, even without the assassination, because of the economic warfare going on.
So what are they going to do? What options do they have?
Oh, they have a lot of options. And I think right next door in Iraq, there are more of them. The talk you've heard, I think, is very much to the point of how some of these militias in Iraq that have been supported by Iran and are associated with Iran can do a lot of damage to the U.S. personnel still there, whether it's our embassy or our troops who are still there. And really, there are many other options in terms of irregular asymmetric operations, as the term often goes, which gets into terrorist possibilities against U.S. military and diplomatic personnel anywhere in the world, really. So we haven't heard the end of this. And we are today, even though the Iranians in the immediate aftermath of the missile strike on the Iraq bases said, this concludes, that's what the foreign minister said, you know, this concludes our response to the Soleimani killing. Now we are hearing more mixed messages from some senior Iranian security and military officials that strongly suggest it really didn't conclude it. So in addition to the felt need to strike back for all the economic sanctions, I think we haven't heard the end of the story with regard to responding to the Soleimani assassination.
How liable are the Iranians to seek out targets in this country?
I don't think that's the most likely thing they're going to do, barring further U.S. military attacks on Iranian interests. I think we'll probably see things overseas, but we cannot rule it out. And look at the logic, if we can call it that, that the administration has used to justify the Soleimani assassination. As you pointed out, they haven't come up with really much information about so-called imminent attacks. But the other line we've heard, particularly from Secretary of State Pompeo, is, well, this is somebody who had blood on his hands, you know, things he did in the past, never mind what's imminent. Well, if that is the metaphor that is going to be applied to a senior military or political figure, we need to be very careful about how it could be applied back to our own people. You know, though much of that American blood on Soleimani's hands was shed in Iraq as part of the Iraq War, which the United States started as a war of choice, an offensive war, ordered by a U.S. president, commanded by U.S. generals. The closest thing to a truly tit-for-tat response by Iran to the Soleimani assassination would be an assassination of a senior U.S. military or political figure, especially one who has been associated with operations like the Iraq War. I mean, you and I could come up with prominent names and who ought to be concerned about their personal security these days. I would not rule that out. As I say, I don't think, because Iran is not looking to see this confrontation escalate anymore, they will continue to hold that particular powder dry. But I think we really need to worry about exactly what a true tit-for-tat response to that Soleimani killing would be. And we're talking about assassination of well-known and admired U.S. figures, including possibly here in the United States.
What do you make of congressional reaction so far?
Well, I'm struck particularly by, you know, Senator Lee's Republican of Utah response to the so-called briefing they got. He was extremely displeased about it. And I think that jives with what you and I were talking a few minutes ago about, that there just hasn't been information coming out that suggests there really was intelligence about some imminent terrorist operation. And particularly, I think Senator Lee was one of these who expressed his displeasure about it, being told in effect by the senior administration briefers, you shouldn't even question this. You shouldn't debate going to war with Iran on some place like the floor of the Senate, because this could give, you know, comfort to our enemy. And this was a direct affront to the role of the Article I branch, the U.S. Congress, in deliberating about something as serious as going to war against a foreign power. I'm not surprised that it got some strongly negative reactions, not only from the Democrats, but at least from a couple of the Republicans like Senator Lee.
There have been a number of people who've suggested that indeed this was a political move on the part of the president to distract from the impeachment that has already occurred in the House. Do you believe that it could have an effect on the thinking of those in the Senate?
Well, on that question in particular, we're talking about just the reality of this extreme party loyalty that has kicked in on so many other issues, both foreign and domestic. We've seen a little bit more departure from it on a couple of these foreign policy issues, more so than the domestic. So I would not bet my rent money on, you know, more Republican defections on that particular issue. But we should, Diane, since you bring up the wag the dog scenario, you know, one of the pieces of evidence, I think, that suggests that this was in the mind of Donald Trump is that back during the President Obama's presidency, Trump was saying, I think this was particularly during the 2012 re-election campaign, he said several times that President Obama might do exactly that sort of thing, start a war with Iran as a way of rallying the flag around him so he could do better and win the election. So we know that Donald Trump was already thinking in these terms, and it's not much of a stretch to suggest that he's thinking in those terms today, especially after he's been impeached.
What does Donald Trump want from Iran?
Great question. And if you apply it to the whole Trump administration, you're going to get different answers if you're talking about different individuals. I think what Donald Trump most wants is not a war. He wants a deal. He's always been talking about a better deal than what Obama got. And if he ever were to get a new negotiated agreement, which would cover nuclear issues, even if it were not much different at all from the deal that he trashed, he would, as he's done on trade issues, for example, proclaim it as much, much better and you know, far better than what Obama was able to get. That's what he most wants. There are other people who have been in his administration. I think that was true of John Bolton, now departed. I think it's probably true of Secretary Pompeo, who are much friendlier to the idea of escalating into a military confrontation. You know, Bolton was quite explicit in calling for bombing Iran. So it's been a very muddled message from this administration in terms of exactly what the end game is or what the desire is. But as far as Donald Trump is concerned, he bills himself as a deal maker, and he would like something that he can bill as a better deal with Iran than his predecessor.
And we don't know exactly what that better deal would consist of.
Well, I think this is the one end game exit that I would strongly point to, and that is essentially a reinstatement of the nuclear deal, but with enough changes, just enough changes, so that the president can say, yes, it's a far better deal. That's basically what he did with NAFTA, where he said, you know, it's the worst deal ever. And then he comes up with his own version of a North American trade deal, which was minor tweaks on NAFTA. And he says, this is the best deal we've ever had. Well, he can operate the same way if we could somehow get the diplomacy started. With this issue with Iran, and if there's a way out of it, that's the way.
It reminds me that we heard just this morning that President Trump had sent birthday greetings to the leader of North Korea.
It's remarkable how Iran, despite being denounced repeatedly as a bunch of authoritarians, of course, by this administration, and it does depart from a good democracy in many ways, as we know, that it's the one regime that is described as authoritarian whose leader does not have the affection of our president, a category which includes Kim Jong-un and Vladimir Putin and Duterte in the Philippines and now Erdogan in Turkey and others.
Speaking of all those other leaders, to what extent does the assassination of Soleimani give them an upper hand in the whole global foreign policy realm?
Well, I don't know about upper hand, but we do need to worry about the broader effects of something like the assassination operation, not just on what the Iranians will do, but what these other regimes will do. And North Korea, indeed, is one that has in the past, under the father or grandfather of the current leader, conducted assassinations of foreign leaders. The North Koreans once tried to kill off the entire South Korean cabinet when they were visiting in Burma back in the 1980s. They've gotten out of this, but if the United States has gotten into the practice of assassinating foreign leaders, senior leaders of regimes that they don't like, that is all but a green light to the North Koreas of the world to get back in that game themselves. And we've noticed statements from the Putin regime in Russia that have called attention to how big a departure this was. Murdering, that was their word, you know, murdering a foreign leader. And this is this was something that the United States had done that other countries weren't doing. So yes, those other regimes have taken notice, and we ought to worry about how they're going to respond.
Paul Pillar, thank you.
Thank you, Diane.
And that's all for today. Find us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Kenny Pirog and Natalie Yurev-Livker. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Reams.